Thanks. And thanks, Jamie and Andrea, for an excellent presentation on handling the G8. I think I'm going to append a few things onto their work about looking at some of the connection points between the G8 and militarism, and where a lot of this work comes to intersect. First, I want to thank the organizers for inviting me here today. I'm the issue campaigns coordinator for the Council of Canadians. I'm also the chair for an informal group called the International Network on Disarmament and Globalization, which brings together researchers and activists in about 300 of them in about 30 countries that was formed in 1999 to look at the links between globalization and militarism. And there's some materials here on the front, and please help yourself and feel free to take some with you. I want to say that just coming here today, I was thinking how important this meeting is today, and it's the turnout has been absolutely terrific, and the other presentations have been really inspiring, and I think it's a very good sign when you can see people coming together around a very important issue like this, and I always feel really good when it's the Council of Canadians and the Anti-Capitalist Collective are on the same bill at the same time. I think that's a very good sign and underscores how important this critical issue is. I'm also going to look a little bit at the G8 and how it connects into militarism, and also the notion of the workshops was to really stimulate a discussion around strategy and how we can look at building an anti-war movement, and so I hope that we have some time at the end to be able to do that. And I'm going to throw out a couple of ideas toward the end of my comments here, and maybe we'll be able to start some discussion. But let's look at, I just want to map out, now there's lots of connection points, but I just want to map out a few of them that I think are quite key in understanding how globalization, and we've already understood how to explain how the G8 is really the executive board of globalization. But how does globalization and militarism connect? I would say that there's really two main areas in the way that globalization intersects with militarism. One, it creates the conditions for war. Globalization very clearly creates the conditions for war. And secondly, it provides the means to wage war. That is, it builds and concentrates wealth into military industries and empowers military institutions. But first, let's look at how globalization creates the conditions for war. I mean, I think it's been part of our analysis for a number of years of how globalization builds fences around governments. It limits the ways in which governments can regulate capital, regulate the economy, and create a sustainable and equitable society for people to live. So globalization through trade agreements fence in governments from being able to do this. At the same time, they promote and exacerbate environmental destruction through rapid consuming of natural resources and also limiting environmental regulations where it's even possible to have those. It erodes social programs, which are vital for creating a society that's socially just. Also, it promotes privatization and deregulation at the same time, which all of these things combined create terrible inequality, resource competition in societies. And we know through decades of experience that these are always the precursors for conflict. These are the root causes of conflict. And I want to quote from Susan George here in this booklet that's WTO Global War System that's up here, and I think I see some people have picked it up here. But Susan George says, between 1990 and 1996, there were 98 major wars, and overwhelmingly these wars were civil wars. They're within countries, not between countries. And the Peace Research Institute in Oslo found that these wars share some characteristics, and here they are. One, they take place chiefly in poor countries where agriculture is still the main contributor to the economy. Environmental factors are most frequently associated with civil conflict, and these factors are land degradation, low fresh water availability per capita, high population density as well, too. Three, there's a particular strong correlation between high external debt and the incidence of civil war. Four, falling export incomes from primary commodities is closely associated with the outbreak of civil war. And five, a history of vigorous IMF intervention is also positively linked with all forms of political and armed conflict. all of these characteristics that Susan George puts out here are created and exacerbated through globalization. And we see the end result leads to conflict. So that's how globalization really creates the conflicts for war, or creates the conditions, rather, for war. Now let's look at how globalization creates the means to wage it. As I mentioned, globalization serves to empower industrialized, wealthy northern industrialized countries. It favors them. It favors the transnational corporations that are in those countries, and creates a concentration of wealth globally within the northern industrialized countries. And these are the countries, as represented in the G8, that really control and manage the global economy, of course, for their own benefit. But this isn't this correlation isn't necessarily new. I mean, if we look back in history at the creation of the British Empire, for example, that colonial powers, when they had far-flung empires, when they were drawing resources from around the world in order to benefit the mother country, that sounds pretty similar. It was a few hundred years old. At the same time, there was a rapid expansion of naval power because the governments understood that as their economic well-being was pushed off into the colonies and the trade routes became much longer, they needed navies to protect their interests, not only in the colonies, but all the vital transportation routes that were developed at that time. And you may be surprised to know that this lesson has not been lost in the highest echelons of U.S. military planners. A document was made available a few years ago from the U.S. Space Command when they've been steadily pushing away in the U.S. administrations to build the missile shield or the Star Wars missile defense system. And in a document that they outlined called Vision for 2020, they likened the need for a missile shield and the militarization of space directly to the need, why the British Empire needed navies. And they specifically said to protect U.S. interests and investments around the world. That was what the militarization of space and the missile shield, this modern, high-tech, biggest military undertaking in the world, is being compared back to. That's globalization. I want to just to illustrate this point again about how military power is used to enforce the corporate interests of globalization. This is a magazine I get at home. It's always very interesting to read. It's called Defense News. And this magazine goes around the world. It's a product of the defense industry, and it's really directed at military decision makers, policy analysts, and the heads of arms corporations. It's almost an industry trade magazine for the arms industry. But they also the corporations advertise in here towards government decision makers. And I just want to show you this one ad from Boeing, which I think is just outrageous. This is an Apache helicopter here. This is like about a $25 million completely lethal helicopters made by Boeing. These are Hellfire missiles on it. You'll note that Israel has these, and when they blow up buildings or target specific vehicles in Israel, these high-tech assassinations that they do, they're using Apache helicopters most often. And I want to show you the ad. It says here, it keeps the peace, right? But if you look in the fine print underneath, it says, in a dominating, intimidating sort of way. Right, so this is how the arms industry, the global arms industry, and the use of military force protects corporate interests and defends globalization. These types of war economies are promoted by the trade agreements themselves. You see, the WTO is the main organization that creates and writes the agreements and then adjudicates disputes between countries. They really codify, they write the rules of the global economic system. And within the WTO main agreement called the GATT, and in fact all trade agreements, if you actually take the time to sit down and look for them, you'll find there's always a clause that's called a security exception. So while all the other clauses are about how governments can't pass laws to protect the environment, can't take health and safety measures that may cost a corporation money in their investments, that can't favor local economies over that, all of these things that governments can't do, there's a security exception that says, oh, well, given all that, governments can do anything they want to fund and provide for a military establishment. That is, supply subsidies to arms industries, to buy arms, to create standing armies, to give special contracts to only local producers. Governments have carte blanche to provide and create these military economies. So, you see, on the one hand, this fits. It makes sense, right? That northern industrialized countries, if they're creating this vast global system that is built upon exploitation of resources and people and labor from around the world, they need this massive military system in order to defend it, to protect it, so that if any challengers arise, they can be crushed quickly and they can defend their interests. And remember, in the minds of these governments, national interests and corporate interests are one and the same thing. You know, what's good for General Motors is good for America, as the old quote goes by. It's actually a quote by the guy that actually built the Pentagon. He was a former General Motors executive, and he built the Pentagon during the Second World War, and that was his quote. At the same time, in the developing world, this has a terrible effect, because many countries that are trying to build their own economies through job creation programs and getting technology transfer from the north down south, some of these, like you think of countries like South Africa and Brazil and Thailand and countries like this, the only way that their governments are able to do it without being challenged by other WTO countries is through military spending. So the natural impetus is to drive industrial money, the money that you would have to help build, say, local car plants or buses or shipbuilding. You can't do that in the WTO rules, but you can do it through the military. So you build a shipbuilding industry by building warships instead of cargoes or oil tankers or things like that. So it just creates, it militarizes the entire economy. So essentially, globalization sees the role of nation states as merely to provide for a military establishment and to create order within a police force and courts and things like that. Everything else is largely seen as illegitimate. Tax collection, too, is also seen as sacred as well, too, because you have to pay for all this. So what we're seeing it develop is what I would liken to as a corporate security state. That the state is a corporate security state. It's providing security for corporations. It's not providing what we would call human security, security for people anymore. It's abandoning that role. That is the main role, providing subsidies, facilitating trade agreements, free trade agreements, which allow corporations to gain more and more power and more wealth, and also providing against security and protection by anyone that would challenge that system. I think what we've seen in recent months is a rapid escalation. You know, we've seen the war front, which protects corporate interests around the world, but we've also seen the war on terror here at home, through so-called anti-terrorism legislation that severely curtails civil liberties like Bill C-36, C-42 in the States. It's called the Patriot Act in Britain. It has another name, which is our laws have been patterned on, and we're seeing these emerge all over the place. So the system is seeing that there are challenges from outside. There are also challenges from internally in the States, too. So it's more police, more intrusion, more spying, bigger police, heavier police presences at demonstrations that all of us have participated in. And I don't have to, you know, I think we have some examples of some of those people here in this room that have faced up against that police harassment and intimidation and protection of corporate interests internally in Canada more than anyone in the country. I think some of those people here in this room, including Jay and Dexter and Aziz and all kinds, and there's probably others and people in the room as well, too. So that's a new external, internal security system that the corporate security state is developing. Well, let's look at the G8. And we've already talked about how the G8 is really the executive of the global economy. And they'll be meeting in Kananaskis this year. They call this a really informal grouping. You know, all we're just old buds that are just getting together over beers to chat, you know. And this is how they've been characterizing the G8. But it really is the executive of the global economy. And they really will be discussing a number of issues which have come to the fore, especially in the post-September 11th climate. One of those areas was they'll be working for an increase in military spending. The United States has long been saying that its allies, especially Canada, has been not spending enough on defense. Well, it seems they have a whole new ready audience for this now, and we have seen in the last few years, and we will see in the coming years, a rapid escalation of military spending in Canada and in Europe, in Asia. Many, many countries are now increasing their defense budgets. This is the first time that we've seen this escalation really since the end of the Cold War, where there has been a decline in spending in many countries, rightly so, because the Cold War was over. We expected to have the peace dividend at that point. But now that peace dividend is being clawed back slowly and slowly, and we're seeing military spending on the rise again. And as you noted in this handout, of the $800 billion that is spent on arms and military establishments around the world every year, the G8 accounts for more than 75% of that. So they'll be looking for more military spending. They'll need this money to wage the war on terror, of which everybody, all the countries, the allies of the United States are expected to play a part. Also, they'll need to stimulate war industries, stimulate their own domestic economy through military spending, through some of the examples that I mentioned. If you look at the list of corporations that are the biggest weapons corporations in North America and in all the members of the G8 countries, you'll see that these are aerospace corporations, they're high-tech corporations. These are really the defining industries of northern industrialized economies, and these are the main beneficiaries of increased military spending. So they can stimulate the whole economy by pumping more money into the arms industry. They'll also be looking at how ways of integrating the arms industries between Europe and North America and all of the countries, how they can get greater cooperation, less competition between the industries of all the countries. So you'll have strategic partnerships from BAE Systems, which is Britain's biggest arms and aerospace corporation. You'll see cooperative agreements perhaps between them and Boeing. Lockheed Martin will build, which is the world's largest arms corporation, will build links with other countries as well. Canada is intricately connected into the U.S. economy, and we will see an increase in the number of Canadian corporations, even those that aren't involved in arms, will be trying to sell into the U.S. Arms market. So I think that's those are some of the main issues that we'll be seeing, and of course getting greater buy-in around the global economy as well. The WTO has just launched the Doha round, which was just put together and rescued really in last November. Prior to September 11th, there was a real serious chance that there would be no new round of free trade negotiations at the WTO. There was just too many competing interests and too many southern countries saying it's going too fast, we can't keep up, it's damaging our economies, we need help, we need special exclusions. And this really threatened to pull the whole system apart. But in post-September 11th, you know, the word came down, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. And the United States, through arm twisting and carrots, gave free trade deals to Indonesia and other countries to get their participation in the war on terror, and also to get their support for a new round at the WTO. And so through tremendous consolidation, when November came, suddenly there's a new round of negotiations at the WTO, which is going to expand the whole neoliberal free trade, global free trade agenda for the coming years. So these two things became linked together. You know, I mean, we had the Bob Zolick, who is the U.S. trade representative, was going around making speeches saying free trade fights terrorism. You know, and then they began, critics of globalization in Geneva were being called intellectual terrorists because we opposed the free trade agenda. So let's look at the last question, which I think is a really strategic one that we gather here at this conference, is how do we build an anti-war movement, anti-corporate globalization movement that fits together? I don't have any magic solutions here, and I think we all need to sort of talk collectively. But there is a crisis, I would say, you know, in all of our social movements, especially in North America. I don't think it's so bad in Europe and in other countries where they've actually been strengthened, but we are quite weak. I would say the peace movement is not in good shape in Canada today. There are pockets of very good organizations and good links are being made, but it hasn't become a broad-based political force yet that I can see. I think the seeds are there and there's possibility there, but we need to do more work to get it to put together. Previously, up until last year, many peace groups had gone away. They had morphed into anti-corporate globalization groups. A lot of activists had moved over into the environment movement. And so there's been a real loss, I think, of experience and knowledge around anti-war issues. And so we need to rebuild that. Also, those analyses need to be updated. A lot of our analysis stems back to the Cold War, and the system has shifted so much. They need to be readapted for globalization. We need to better understand how these issues are linked together. The current conflict now, war is a wedge issue in Canada, both for the right and for the left. It divides movements. It doesn't really bring them together. It's been a terribly difficult process to get groups to work together to take anti-war stances. I'll give you, for example, I was part of a number of groups that tried to put together the September 11th Peace Coalition early on, take a strong anti-war stance. The Council of Canadians, a number of trade unions were involved, but the Canadian Labour Congress would not sign on. They would not join the anti-war movement. And so while some affiliates would, the CLC wouldn't, and it prevented a lot of organizations from getting involved. So there's still deep divisions within the left on this. So I will end at that, but I do want to say there are tremendous opportunities for us to build a movement, to build an anti-corporate globalization and an anti-war movement here in Montreal. Montreal is one of the real nerve centers for the arms industry in Canada. Bombardier is based here, CAE is based here, Bell Helicopter is here. These are some of the largest weapons corporations in the world, and they're right here in Montreal. So this is an especially strategic city in the whole North American framework to have a strong anti-corporate, anti-war movement. So I really look forward to our discussion and developing strategies on how to deal with this new corporate security state. Thanks so much.